And Judge Larson directed Sheriff Robinson to arrest Vicki and deliver the Singer children to the Division of Family Services. Go get those kids. Did the sheriff go out there wearing his badge to do it? Listen close. Now comes what was called the Los Angeles Times caper. And the Los Angeles Times had nothing to do with it. On the morning of October 18th, 2 days later, John received a long-distance phone call from a man who identified himself as Bob Wilson, a freelance writer who had been assigned with the Los Angeles Times. You wonder why I do not respond to everybody who calls up and says they're a newsman? To write an article on the Singer's juvenile court problem, Wilson was willing to pay John $600 for an exclusive interview. John agreed to do the interview, but declined to accept payment for it. Wilson said he would be flying into Salt Lake City on the following day and would like to drive up to see John around 6 in the evening. He would bring his two photographers with him. John said he'd be glad to meet with him at that time. Just one thing, I'd like to talk to you in private. There are some things I want to ask you about that I wouldn't feel comfortable discussing in front of your family. That was all right with John. Okay, then, I'll see you tomorrow night. Thanks, Mr. Singer. At 5:45 p.m. the following day, John got a call from Bob Wilson, the Los Angeles Times reporter by self-proclamation. Wilson and his two photographers were in Heber City, 20 miles southwest of Marion, needed directions to the Singer farm. Wilson reminded John they had agreed to conduct the interview in private. The sun had not quite sunk behind the Wasatch Range when Wilson drove a black Lincoln Continental inside the gate, followed by a blue van. Both vehicles had California license plates. LA Times. John came out of the log house alone and greeted them. A tall, distinguished-looking man in his late 30s got out of the car and met John halfway between the gate and the house, extending his right hand. "Mr. Singer," he says, "I'm Bob Wilson." They shook hands. Wilson seemed to be sizing John up, glancing up and down his wiry frame. "Come on, meet my camera crew," he said, pointing to the van where two stocky, well-dressed men emerged from the side door, one carrying a 35-millimeter camera on a tripod. They left the van door open, and John could see there was more photography equipment inside. Wilson ushered John over to the van. "I'd like you to meet Grant Larson," he said, standing behind John as the two men shook hands. Larson clasped John's hand firmly and suddenly grabbed John's right wrist. Let me read this again. Wilson ushered John over to the van. "I'd like you to meet Grant Larson," he said, standing behind John as the two men shook hands. Move around here. Just move your camera around here. You get me, Peter, so I can move fast. I'm tired of looking the way I've been looking. Listen close. You're not going to believe this. Wilson ushered John over to the van. "I'd like you to meet Grant Larson," he said, standing behind John as the two men shook hands. Larson clasped John's hand firmly and suddenly grabbed John's right wrist with his left hand. In the same instant, Wilson wrapped his right arm around John's neck from behind and grabbed for his left arm. The other photographer dropped his tripod and moved in from the side to grab John's legs. John struggled violently as they dragged him over to the open door of the van. He yelled for Al Ryder. Larson, who had John's right arm, jumped into the van and started pulling John inside. Most of the family had gathered at Shirley's house to watch the 6 o'clock news on his property. Suzanne was sitting closest to the living room window, which looked out on the driveway. When she heard shouting from outside, she stood up and glanced out the window. The rest of the family was startled by her cry, "They're trying to take Daddy! They're trying to take Daddy!" It took a couple of seconds to register in their minds. Then Vicky, his wife, was on her feet and out the front door. Al Ryder, who was there, rushed to the window to see what was happening. He saw John struggling with three men, and he could see that they were trying to get John into the van. Ryder ran out the front door just behind Shirley and was followed by Suzanne, Charlotte, Joseph, Benjamin, and Nancy. Julie Nine stayed behind with three-year-old Israel. Timothy and Grant were playing on the trampoline south of the garden when they heard John's shouts. They stood still listening. John was calling for help. They trotted to the corner of the barn, peered at the scene. They saw Vicky running out of Shirley's house, headed for the melee. Followed by Al and Shirley, Timmy and Grant joined the ranks and ran to help John. Heidi had just come inside from practicing with her bow, which John had recently bought her for hunting. Still had a quiver of arrows strapped to her back. She heard shouts, looked out the window, picked up her bow, and ran out to her father's defense. During this time, John had been able to brace his left arm against the door of the van and kept from being pulled the rest of the way in. The man holding John's legs let go of them and tried to grab John's left arm. Seizing this opportunity, John summoned all his strength and, kicking away from the van with his left foot and pushing with his left arm, hauled all three of his assailants away from the van and onto the ground. In a mad flurry of arms and legs and determined faces, the three men regained control of their prey, Larson holding John's left arm, Wilson again on John's back, and the third man holding his right arm. John's legs were spread wide and his back was bent forward. He was being forced into a crouching position. Larson pulled a pair of handcuffs from his back pocket. "Get these on him," he yelled to his two cohorts. In that instant, John freed his left hand, reached under his jacket, and pulled a .38 automatic pistol from his waistband. Still bent over, his hands nearly touching the ground, he cocked the gun and pointed it alternately at the legs of Larson and the man on the right, yelling, "Get off of me or I'll kill you." Now listen. They're newspaper men. Out of the corner of his eye, Wilson saw the horde of angry family members coming toward him, still with a grip on John's arm. They're newspaper men on his property, from his view, kidnapping him. Out of the corner of his eye, Wilson saw the horde of angry family members coming toward him. Still with a grip on John's arm, he shouted at John while trying to stay calm, "We'll leave, Mr. Singer. If we let go, don't shoot. We'll leave. Don't shoot." As soon as he said that, Vicky, John's wife, came crashing into Wilson from the side, grabbing his tie in her left hand, holding her fist in front of his face. "I'll knock your teeth out," she screamed with a wild look in her eye. "That thing's out of focus, Peter. Sit down and brace it. Not working? Well, quit using it. Go back there and find somebody that can fix it. I only want focus pictures going up, unless it's a bureaucrat that's just been hit." Vicky came crashing into Wilson from the side, grabbing his tie in her left hand and holding her fist in front of his face. "I'll knock your teeth out," she screamed with a wild look in her eyes. Celtic moment, I bet you. Wilson let go of John and backed away, saying, "No, don't." As he backed away, his tie came off in Vicky's hand, and she threw it to the ground. Arriving at the scene, Ryder ran at Wilson as he was retreating. Wilson ducked behind the van. Al then made a dart at Larson, who let go of John, backed away, holding his hands in the air as a sign of surrender. The third assailant was beset by screaming children, beating on his back and head. John stood up, ruffled and shaking, and pointed his gun at Larson, who was standing at the passenger door of the van, then at Wilson. who was on the other side of the van looking over the hood, and at the third man who was still backing away from the angry children. Don't shoot. We're unarmed, Larson yelled, looking sickly scared, still with his arms in the air. Al Ryder stepped between John and the van. Who are you and what do you want? He demanded of the three men. Larson said, we're police officers, and pulled a wallet from his jacket, which when it fell open revealed a shiny badge. They obtained entrance by fraud. They assassinated every newsman in the world. Small wonder nobody can trust a representation. We're leaving. Don't shoot, Wilson begged. Still shaking, John said, get off of my property and don't ever show your ugly faces around here again or I'll blow your heads off. Wilson ran to the Lincoln as the other two officers got into the van. Both vehicles backed all the way down the lane to Upper Loop Road, faster than anybody ever went down that road forwards or backwards. Listen close. Vicki walked over to John and put her hand on his chest. His heart was pounding furiously. They walked arm in arm up the driveway and into the log house. John was so emotionally drained that he had to lie down on the couch in the living room. He still lowered a bit. He still had his gun in his hand and was inspecting it when he called Vicki over and said, Vicki, don't tell anyone. But my gun wasn't loaded. When reporters from the Park Record arrived an hour later, though, John was standing sentry in the darkness, his rifle held across his chest in front of the log house. Al Ryder was patrolling the border of the farm with an M1 carbine. Inside, practically every member of the household was armed. Vicki and Shirley wore pistols and leather holsters. Timmy had a BB gun. Heidi still wore a quiver, and some of the younger children had knives sheathed to their belts. More reporters and television crews drove up to the farm. Every time he saw a new set of headlights come up the lane, John picked up his rifle and went out to see who the visitors were. He was nervous as he talked with them. Bob Wilson was really Robert Wadman. I could do something with that. Director of the Division of Narcotics and Liquor Law Enforcement. The way these different departments peddle back and forth. The second man, Grant Larson, was Wadman's assistant director. They sent these lying bureaucrats used to dealing with narcotics and liquor law enforcement to go after this man who just wanted to teach his own kids. The third man, Bill Riggs, was an officer of the division. All three testified later that they had identified themselves as the police and told John that he was under arrest from the moment they grabbed him. The plan had been devised by Wadman and approved by Sheriff Robinson. At the time of the arrest attempt, four sheriff's cars were waiting on Upper Loop Road to go in and clean up the rest. If the attempt was successful and they got John out. That is, they would arrest Vicki, put the Singer children in the DFS detention center. Grant Larson later testified that John was the toughest man I ever grabbed hold of. On the same morning, Summit County Attorney Robert Adkins filed a criminal complaint charging John with three counts of aggravated assault for resisting arrest with a gun. A justice of the peace issued a felony warrant for John's arrest. A felony warrant permits the use of deadly force to effect an arrest. That means now they could arrest him and kill him if necessary. And the felony warrant was based upon him using an unloaded gun to protect himself against people who alleged to be newsmen. And in his view and everybody else's view, were trying to kidnap him. Now with the felony warrant issued, as law compounds its technicalities upwards, deadly force can be used in the arrest. They planned the arrest. Robert Wadman was still in on it. They thought ways in which they could get him. They considered, am I boring you? Because we're going to get down to the killing now. They considered cutting off the singer's supply of food and water and shutting off their electricity in the hope that John would be forced to surrender. That wouldn't work. They were self-reliant. Then they considered driving an armored personnel carrier into the compound. They approached Governor Matheson for his permission to use the National Guard's armored vehicle. But the governor vetoed the plan out of his main concern about the potential danger to the children. They wanted a SWAT team, but Provo and Ogden city attorneys advised against loaning their SWAT teams. Around the middle of December, Wadman, Robinson, Lunan, and Reed decided on a plan that they would use. They rented a house in an A-frame place next to him. They set up surveillance 24 hours a day to watch all of his habits, and they decided the best way to get him was when he went out to the mailbox, which was some distance from his house, that would separate him from the rest of the family. He knew what they were doing. They watched John through binoculars, and he watched them. The county attorney began to press his arrogant case and forced the sheriff served an order on the sheriff to show why he shouldn't be held in contempt for failing to go out and get his job done. After 18 days of surveillance, they formulated an arrest plan. At 10 a.m. Wednesday, January 17th, 12 law enforcement officers assembled in the briefing room of the Narcotics and Liquor Law Enforcement Office in downtown Salt Lake. Robert Wadman, and Ron Robinson were in charge of the briefing. Grant Larson had picked 9 other officers who would accompany him. Among the 9 were 2 Summit County deputy sheriffs, 6 officers from the Division of Narcotics and Liquor, 6 of those guys, 2 officers from the Utah Highway Patrol. In the team were those that had served on the surveillance team. They had taken aerial photographs of the area. The key to the arrest plan was to surprise Singer with such a show of force he would realize the futility of resisting arrest. The arrest team would consist of 5 pairs of officers. Each pair would be assigned a snowmobile. 3 pairs of officers designated as Unit 1 would be stationed at the rented house. Unit 2, comprising of the remaining 2 pairs, would be stationed in the A-frame cabin southeast of the Singer compound. They'd communicate with walkie-talkies. Each pair of officers would consist of a driver and a passenger. Drivers would carry standard police 38 revolvers, and passengers would be armed with 12-gauge shotguns with regulation double-aught buckshot. Each officer would wear a flak vest under a standard-issue raid jacket with the word police in 7-inch high letters on the back. Both units would watch the Singer compound with binoculars and wait for their opportunity. There would be no time limit on the plan. The arrest team would arrive at their position at 6 the following morning, wait until dark if necessary, then go home for the night, return the next morning at 6 until opportunity came. When opportunity presented itself, Grant Larson, who was the team leader, would give the signal to execute the arrest plan. Two pairs of officers from Unit 1 would be deployed in snowmobiles from the surveillance house and proceed south along Upper Loop Road. As Singer headed back up the lane from his mailbox toward his compound, they would turn up the lane and pursue him, identifying themselves as police officers and placing him under arrest. The third pair of Unit 1 officers would drive due south from the surveillance house, emerging from between Watson's and Jepson's houses. Unit 2 would deploy from the A-frame, head west until they reached the corner of the Singer farm, then turn to the north and cut off Singer's retreat. Some many yards from his house, 200 yards I think it was, to the mailbox. Thus surrounded by armed officers, it was reasonable to expect that Singer would submit and surrender to arrest. They had a map on the blackboard, pointed to a fence. One of the officers was to arrive before daylight and cut the hole in the fence without being seen. They took off. Unit 1 would consist of narcotics and liquor officers. Louis Joly, Ron Gunderson, John Shouten, and David Fulmer. Joly was the firearms instructor for the Division of Narcotics and Liquor Law Enforcement. What are these guys doing there? The officers were to drive to Marion in groups, at least three to a car, so they don't arouse any suspicion. They didn't want any news media around. One of the officers asked if there'd be any medical personnel on the scene. They had a Lifeline helicopter unit that would be standing by, they said. Robinson then deputized all the state officers on the arrest team, so they were acting for the local sheriff's office. Later in the day, Ron Gunderson, who had been assigned to drive a snowmobile in Unit 1, spoke to Wadman in the hallway of the Narcotics and Liquor Office. Gunderson told his boss he thought the plan was dangerous, but Wadman was in a hurry and didn't have time to discuss the matter. Not until 2 years later, under oath, was Gunderson asked to explain why he thought the plan was dangerous. He said the key to the plan was that a reasonable man, when surrounded and confronted by show of force, would submit. He says the problem was John Singer was not a reasonable man. Heavy snowstorm hit early Thursday. They're all stationed now. And they receive word that the bad weather prohibited the Lifeline helicopter for medical help from standing by. Saturday was John Singer's 48th birthday. His mother, recently retired at the age of 78, signed over her latest Social Security check to John, saying she still had a little left from the previous month. And since they'd had no work being cooped up in their house, John accepted it gratefully. Grandma was worried sick over John's legal predicament. She was his mother. She noticed that John had lost weight and appeared tense. She seemed to suffer from the pressure he was under even more than he did. She said to him privately, "John, I can't stand that you're so worried. I'm so sick and tired of living." "Mother," he said, "sometimes I am too." Shirley brought her kids over for big family dinner. Most of the food, including birthday cake, was compliments of Bonnie. John explained to the guests the presence of the men in ski clothes riding around his farm on snowmobiles. Said they're cops, or else they're hired by cops to watch us, so they can figure out a way to arrest me. They want us to think they're tourists. The Singers have been watching the surveillance team through binoculars all week. John pointed out the irony of it. He says, "You know something? That old A-frame house where the men are stationed in is where I began to learn the gospel. Unc got me on my feet and started training me, and Vicky and I spent many, many times in Unc's house studying scriptures together. Just think of it. Those guys are after me living in that house where I learned the scripture." John was in good humor that evening, though, as they all sang songs and danced to the music on the radio. They hadn't seen the snowmobiles now for a few days, but on the 18th of January, there seemed to be at least three of them, and now the police were in uniform. John went outside with his rifle and a gas-driven snowblower to clear the lane, because Shirley's oldest daughter, Brenda George, who lived in Commas, had promised to deliver some groceries in the afternoon. John left the rifle by the gate that he always carried and cleared a parking place in the driveway. Then he started clearing the lane outside his gate. He was wearing a sheepskin-lined blue coat, a blue watch cap, and leather gloves. The snow had stopped falling, but the sky was still a metallic gray. John saw the mailman come while he was blowing the snow to the mailboxes on Upper Loop Road. Since he could see no snowmobiles in the area, and since he was almost halfway down the lane already, he decided to go down to the mailbox to pick up the mail. He put the snowblower down and trudged west through the fresh snow toward Upper Loop Road. In the log house, 10-year-old Charlotte Singer was watching her father with binoculars out the living room window. As soon as the mailman made his delivery, Grant Larson, one of the officers, knowing John was already outside his compound, told his unit at the A-frame to stand by. "This might be our chance," he said. Officers Henley and Carlson went outside and prepared to start their snowmobiles. Larson radioed to Lou Jolly at the surveillance house, "You guys be ready. If Singer goes down to get his mail, it's a go." About the time John walked past Watson's property at the foot of the lane, Esther Watson came out of the house, got into her car in the driveway, and started the engine. She let it warm up a few minutes. John reached Upper Loop Road. Am I boring you? John reached Upper Loop Road and walked 5 yards south. You see, I want people that support us in our fight of truth and freedom to know this ain't no game we're playing. There is a real need in this country to understand what's happening. John reached Upper Loop Road and walked 5 yards south to the mailbox. In it, he found two letters to Shirley and a large envelope addressed to Vicki and him. The officers in the surveillance house could not see the mailboxes because the Watsons' house was in their line of sight. They had to wait for Grant Larson to give the signal from the A-frame. As soon as Singer got to the mailbox, Larson gave the signal. "Let's go," he said to his men, and into his walkie-talkie simultaneously. He waited for Jolly's acknowledgement. Then he and Floyd Farley ran out of the A-frame carrying their shotguns and jumped onto the back seats of the snowmobiles as Carlson and Henley started the engines. At the surveillance house, Lou Jolly yelled, "It's a go!" And he and his officers ran to their snowmobiles. The vehicle carrying Gunderson and Fulmer led the way, followed by Shouten and Jolly out the driveway south on Upper Loop Road toward the private lane. Bates and Hayward headed for the area between Watson's and Jepson's houses. John had already turned up the lane and was walking east toward his farm when the two snowmobiles started south. You know, I feel for some of these people like I felt by that sheriff that said to the pastor he arrested in his pulpit, "I'm just doing my job." There's some jobs you don't have to do. You can quit, you know. John had already turned up the lane and was walking east toward his farm when the two snowmobiles started south on Upper Loop Road from the surveillance house. John glanced over his left shoulder at them but seemed unconcerned. He took two more steps and stopped, turned around, and looked again, his eyes wide. He saw the shotguns in the hands of Fulmer and Jolly. He realized that as they got close to the lane, they slowed down, preparing to turn. John turned again and started running homeward. As soon as the two snowmobiles turned up the lane, Jolly yelled, "We're police officers! You're under arrest!" Now, Shouten and Jolly sped ahead of Gunderson and Fulmer, gaining on John as he was about halfway between Upper Loop and Watson's driveway. As they got closer, John looked back over his right shoulder. Seeing that they could overtake him in a few seconds, he pulled a pistol from his waistband with his right hand and waved it back and forth in approximately a 45-degree arc in the general direction of his pursuers. Notice he didn't shoot. He had announced repeatedly he would never fire until fired on. He kept running toward home, but now he was almost sidestepping, his left shoulder pointing east, his feet pointing southeast. He looked alternately back at the officers and forward in the direction he was running. Gunderson and Shouten slowed their vehicles, just keeping pace with Singer. Immediately, Jolly yelled twice, "Halt! Police! Drop your gun!" Gunderson also yelled, "Police officer, drop your gun!" When Charlotte saw her father start to run from the snowmobile, she turned around and called to Vicki, "They're getting Dad. Get the gun." Vicky rushed to the window. Charlotte handed her the binoculars. Vicky saw John running toward her, nearing Watson's driveway, waving his gun behind him at the officers as if to say, "Get away, leave me alone." Vicky put the binoculars down, ran to Timothy's 22, ran for Timothy's 22 rifle. Jolly raised his shotgun and took aim. As Vicky ran to get Timothy's rifle, Charlotte picked up the binoculars again and looked out the window. She saw her father take two steps toward her, lurch forward and fall. As he fell, his mouth opened and blood flowed out of it. Her mind recoiled in horror. Vicky heard the distant shotgun blast as she picked up the rifle. She froze for a second, but didn't allow herself to think about what the shots could have meant. She ran into her bedroom to put on her boots. Officer Henley was cutting the fence when he heard the shot ring out. He looked up and saw John Singer thrust forward and fall on his face. John braced his arms against the snow and started to get up again, but he couldn't make it. He fell once more and did not move again. Instead of cutting the fence, Henley got back in his snowmobile and drove west parallel to the fence toward Upper Loop Road, followed by Carlson and Larson. Gunderson was driving a few feet behind to the left of Shouten and Jolly when he heard Jolly's shotgun discharge and saw Singer fall. Gunderson stopped his vehicle, pulled his pistol from its holster, and ran over to where Singer was lying face down in the snow. John's right hand still clutched a gun. Gunderson yelled, "Please drop your gun!" Once as he ran, again as he knelt beside the body and held his pistol at the back of Singer's head. Second later, Bates arrived, having run from between the houses, holstered his weapon and grabbed the gun from Singer's hand. As soon as Singer had been disarmed, Gunderson holstered his gun, turned John over. His eyes were open, he was still breathing. Blood was running from his nose and mouth. Gunderson tried to console John, saying, "You're going to be okay. We got help on its way. You'll be okay." John didn't respond, but looked straight ahead, his eyes not focusing. Grant Larson ran up and knelt beside the body. Bates looked at the gun John had waved at the officers. It was a 38 Colt automatic with a live round in the chamber and 7 rounds visible in the clip. He hadn't fired a shot. Shouten and Jolly slowly drove their snowmobile up to where Singer was lying. Jolly was badly shaken, a look of alarm on his face. Tom Carlson drove his truck up to where Singer was lying. He stayed in the driver's seat as Larson and Shouten lifted John and placed him on the seat of the cab, his head resting on Carlson's right thigh. "We'll take Singer to the hospital. Take the snowmobiles to the surveillance house, secure the equipment, wait for orders from the sheriff." The 7 remaining officers looked up the lane and saw Vicky, Shirley, Timothy, and Heidi all armed running toward them. Timothy had picked up John's carbine rifle at the gatepost as they left their property. The officers ran for cover. Deputy Bates yelled from the side of Jepson's house, "Vicky, stop or someone will get hurt." Another officer crouched behind his snowmobile, yelled, "We're police officers. Go back to your home." Vicky and the others stopped running, but continued to walk down the lane. They were confused. John was in trouble, and they were not going to turn around and go home until they found out where he was. Shirley had seen the officers load something into the cab of the truck, but wasn't sure if it was a body or not. None of the others had seen John since he started running up the lane. Floyd Farley, standing behind a telephone pole, looked up and saw Vicky and the others and says, "There's no way I'm going to shoot it out against women and children. Let's get out of here." All 7 of them scrambled for their snowmobiles, rode back to the surveillance house. As they ran, Heidi yelled after them, "You dirty cowards." Vicky, Shirley, Heidi, and Timothy reached the foot of Watson's driveway and found John's hat in the mail lying beside a round, dark pool of blood that was slowly soaking into the snow. They looked around trying to figure out what had happened. They were confused and angry. Some of the younger children came running down the lane after them. Vicky looked toward the neighbors' houses, picked up the hat and mail, and walked home, retrieving the snowblower on the way. If John was in the pickup truck they'd seen driving away, why was it going so slowly, and why did it turn south when the hospital was to the north? Back inside the house, Vicky called Harold and Logan, told him what happened. Within 30 minutes, she got calls from KUTV, the Tribune, and the Park Record. To each, she told the story, still sobbing, in confusing bits and pieces. The sheriff was trying to decide what to have for dessert when he was called to the phone behind the cashier's counter at Dean's Cafe. Sheriff, we got a call from Grant Larson. Mary and John Singer were shot. He's being brought to the county hospital. Old bleep, Ron moaned. Was he hurt bad? I don't know. Were any of the officers hurt? Don't think so. Larson didn't say. Does the press know yet? Sheriff said, we haven't heard from them. Well, don't say anything to them, but we know what happened. I'll be there in 2 minutes. When he got to his office, he called Vicki. The line was busy. When he finally got through, he told her John had been wounded and was on his way to the hospital. And as it was his duty to arrest her, he would send a couple of officers there to pick her up. They'd have to take the children to the Division of Family Services and deliver the children. There, we don't want more bloodshed, he said. She said she'd submit to the arrest, much to the sheriff's relief. She wanted to know how badly John was wounded. The sheriff said he didn't know yet. Before 1 p.m., the highway patrol set up roadblocks to keep out the press and their friends and relatives. The truck carried John to the hospital, 30-minute ride. They laid him face up on a gurney, wheeled him inside. At 1:15 p.m., Dr. John Kumagai pronounced John Singer dead. Officers Larson, Carlson, and Shouten went directly to the sheriff's office from the hospital. The office seemed to be in a state of chaos. Where's Singer, Robinson? The sheriff asked Grant Larson. He's dead. A heavy-hearted feeling came over the sheriff. Larson described the shooting incident, emphasizing that Jolly had feared for his own life when he pulled the trigger. The sheriff called Vicki again. He didn't tell her that John was dead. Knowing that they still had guns up there on the farm, he was worried about the possibility of retaliation or mass suicide, he said. Instead, he told her John had been wounded in the leg, that he had been taken to the University of Utah Medical Center in Salt Lake, and that he would be all right. The sheriff told Vicki that Deputy Leon Wild and Highway Patrol Sergeant Ken Meacham would drive up to get her and the 10 children. Since there were no charges against Shirley, she could stay and take care of the farm. Vicki promised to cooperate. The members of the arrest team followed Ron Robinson back to Colville. They left Marion without having conducted any sort of investigation of the shooting scene. No photographs were taken, no markers placed at the spot where Singer had fallen or where Jolly had fired. No measurements were made as to how far Jolly had been from Singer when he fired. The shell casing ejected from Jolly's gun was never recovered. Vicki believed she was being taken to the hospital to see John. Sergeant Meacham turned his car into a modern six-story building in the southeast corner of downtown Salt Lake, where a sign read, Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office, Salt Lake Police Department. Where are we going? She asked. Meacham didn't answer. They drove down a ramp into the underground garage and stopped next to the building by a sign that said, Salt Lake County Jail. Vicki realized what was about to happen to her. She was handcuffed, led through two heavy steel doors into the booking area of the jail. Meacham removed the handcuffs before he left. Vicki asked him to find out what John's condition was and let her know. Vicki was frisked by a tough-looking woman and then booked on the contempt of court charge, 30 days, no bail. After her fingerprints and mugshot were taken, she was led through two more barred doors to the female wing of the jail. A matron told Vicki to take out her hairpins and unbraid her hair, which, when let down, hung past her waist. Vicki was placed in a clean 10-by-12-foot holding cell that had one small window on the door at eye level. In the cell were a mattress on the floor with a folded army blanket, a wooden bench, a toilet, and a small wash basin. The walls and ceiling were painted beige. The big steel door made a frightful clang when it shut, and Vicki was alone with her anxiety. She'd been in the cell about 10 minutes when the matron opened the door and a young male social worker entered to talk to Vicki. He sat next to her on the bench and told her that he was available if she needed someone to talk to or a shoulder to cry on. A minute later, Sergeant Meacham joined them in the cell. He said, "Vicky, I found out the condition on John, and I'm sorry I have to tell you he's dead." "No. You're lying," Vicky said angrily. "John's still alive, but he will be dead because you guys don't want him alive." Meacham said, "I'm sorry you feel that way, Vicky, but John is dead." Vicky burst into tears, covering her face with her hands, and then held the social worker's arm while she cried on his shoulder. Between sobs, she moaned, "John, oh, my John." His mother learned from a television news bulletin that John had been shot by the lawman. When Bonnie arrived and told her that her son was dead, she wailed, "Oh, I wish I was up there and they'd killed me instead of John. Why wasn't I there? I don't want to live anymore." She became weak and had to sit down. The stir that followed because of the press called for a hearing. At the hearing, Robert Adkins, the county prosecutor who brought it all on, issued a statement regarding the arrest attempt. As officers approached Mr. Singer, he pulled an automatic pistol out of his pocket, out of his coat, raised it, aimed it at the officer nearest him. As Singer's arm was outstretched, that officer fired a shotgun at close range, striking Singer in his right side beneath his arm. No other shots were fired. The picture showed he was shot in the back. While he was running home, the news media carried it accurately. I'll give them credit. Judge frees widow from jail after several days. Saturday morning's front page banner. Test shows Singer shot in the back. Forensic experts found not just one source of shooting. A rather famous attorney, Jerry Spence, filed a $110 million civil rights suit against Utah state, county, and local officials on behalf of John Singer's widow. The judge, he tried to get him to disqualify himself because he was a member of the Mormon Church and had been appointed to the state bench and recommended to the federal bench by one of the defendants and had been a law partner of the chief defense counsel. So how could he be a fair judge? He refused to disqualify himself, and so the district judge shocked the plaintiffs, the news media, and the public by granting summary judgment to dismiss the case for civil rights damages. His 218-page decision picked apart Spence's complaint piece by piece, using adjectives such as ludicrous, far-fetched, and spurious to describe some of its allegations. And with respect to the arrest plan, says this court does not believe a plan is negligent or grossly negligent merely because it involves a show of force. Neither does the court recognize a duty to desist from arresting someone who may draw a weapon, or a duty to ensure that a person who draws a gun will be safely taken into custody. In this court's view, no amount of planning can dictate the actions of an arresting officer. Dismissed it all, calling it a miscarriage of justice, Spence appealed Judge Winder, I could do something with that, Judge Winder's decision to the U.S. Circuit Court in Denver. It's pending there today. His wife, Vicky, has come to peace as she waits. Says if she wins the damage case, she's going to dedicate a large part of it to civil rights defense. As she sits by a tree and tries to let life take meaning for her again. Death of America, an American. The killing of John Singer. Make sure we got it in our bookstore Sunday. I just want to ask the people I can see. Do you find that story? Well, you might not because of the experience you've had with me. But don't you agree that most people will find this story unbelievable for America? Blues Brothers was funny. But the principal was there. Narcotics and liquor enforcement officers. You know, they're calloused enough to have dealt with enough bodies that it's just another piece of meat to them. Doesn't this make you sick? Does it make you mad? Don't you think we ought to stay up there in the sky telling the world what's going on? The only people who can stop this are the people of America, fed up with pompous-assed bureaucrats. This never, ever got to the Supreme Court. It's going there now. Who are more impressed with their badge than they are the Constitution. Sure, this man was disobeying the law, but did he deserve to be killed? And the right to use deadly force was because of what he did when these same officers lied and said they were newsmen and were attempting to kidnap him under false premises. That became the basis. Well, in my opinion, I think they knew what he'd do. That's the way they got him to do something that would let them use deadly force to get him. What do you think of this, folks? The number is 1-800-338-3030.